Welcome once again to another episode of the Veef Show. This is episode 51. We didn't get the nice round number 50, but I am joined once again by
Renato.
You actually want to like? Well, I know you are from the Macross Speaker Podcast. Plug, plug, plug. And but did you want to talk about your credentials? Like, why should people listen to you, other than the fact that you have a terrific English accent?
Not really. I don't think that people care about that kind of stuff, and if they do, it's not really anything that I should be introducing, you know what I mean?
All right, okay. Anyways, we are talking about Yamato Toys, and we decided we were going to do this at some point, but now it's...
It was like half a year ago that you said, because it was right after the 155 talk that we did, right?
Yeah, after the Takatoku podcast.
Yeah, and I remember I said, okay, well, I'll get back to you about that, because I'm going to speak to people at Yamato Toys. And that was like in June.
Yeah.
And then ever since then, I've just been busy with all sorts of other projects.
Yeah.
And really, this month has been... Or like the middle of this month. We're in the middle of this month right now. Yeah, this is really the first opportunity that I've had to actually do something like this. And the timing is perfect now, because Yamato is kind of on its way out.
Kind of.
So we can really like look back.
Yeah, well, they're not dead. They're just sort of like changing their name and their brand a little
bit. Yeah, well, we can explain that. Yeah. We can explain that when we get to it.
You know, this
but this is probably the best time to do a retrospective.
Yeah. This caused a panic, and all the VF19Ps and HLJ are sold out now. So thanks, guys.
I told you, man.
It's like, don't hoard them.
They're like, oh my god, I'm going to hoard them all just in case. And I'm, just in case they run out is actually what they said. And I'm like, you're going to cause them to run out. Don't you understand? No.
It's okay. There's other websites that have them.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let's talk about how the market was for Macross toys before Yamato came around. Because for the longest time, the only toy that persisted in the hearts and minds of the fans was the big Takatoku 155th scale toy.
Yeah.
And this is mostly because the only other toy of that nature was the Bandai High Complete model, which was never reissued.
Right. Yeah. That's if you're talking about like VF1 toys, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, because
they're... Because you had the Macross 7 toys as well.
Yeah, that's true. There were the Macross 7 toys.
Yeah, so when we talk about the market, we have to consider the types of users.
Mm-hmm.
And those Macross 7 toys were marketed towards kids.
Yeah. Although I believe you made a comment that Bandai was not very happy with the performance of those toys. Unlike Victor, who was very happy with all the music sales.
Right. Maybe. Oh. I mean, they pulled out of the smaller scale ones for a reason, right?
Yeah.
They were going to do more micro Macross.
Yeah.
And they were apparently going to do that... Battle 7 Bridge thing, playset kind of thing. The one that you can see in the photographs.
Yeah.
But I don't know where that comes from. I mean, I think I've seen a picture of an ad saying that it was coming soon or something.
Yeah, there's a lot of like random-ass pictures we cannot, for the life of us, source.
Anyway. Sorry. Like, when we talk about the kind of users that would probably go for higher-end items, they didn't really exist. They were kind of in more of a maturing stage still, because we had the garage kit.
Yeah.
That were made by hobby maker companies, like, you know, Studio Hi-Fi and things like that.
Yeah.
So the kind of time period that we're talking about now is mid to late 90s. Mm. Around 98, 99, the Chogokin Tamashii line had started to appear by Bandai.
I mean,
and they were Bandai, and so they could do this.
Well, the thing is that there was sort of a collector's line in, you know, High Complete Bottle, because those were marketed towards adults.
That's
true. Because they had pictures of them next to your hi-fi stereo and, you know, your big TV antenna.
But they still didn't do anything. It wasn't really a big step up engineering-wise from the Takotokus.
No, but there was a bit of a connection because I had heard that the original SoC Mazinger was made off of, like, plans from an HCF Mazinger, or just, like, the basic idea of what the toy was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So they're somewhat connected.
Well, I remember the first Mazinger. Wasn't that, like, you had to put a lot of it together yourself?
Yeah, a lot of the accessories came on sprues.
Yeah. Anyway. So the kind of consumers were mostly into garage kits and die-cast robots. Really wasn't that big a thing. You know, High Complete Model notwithstanding. So for a company like Yamato to get into that, it took a bit of priming. So if we look at what Yamato was prior to them going into making their own toys, they were mostly an importer of these kind of like adult-oriented collector toys.
Like McFarlane?
So they used to deal with... Exactly like McFarlane. Yeah, that's what they used to import.
Oh, okay.
Spawn and Toy Biz stuff.
Okay.
And when I spoke to the guy at Yamato, they said that the average consumer was still quite amazed that there were such products being made for adult consumers overseas, right? So that's how they found their niche within Japan, because people started lighting up to the idea that, so complete toys actually can be something that we can all enjoy.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, though, because, like,
kids.
The Studio Hi-Fi stuff was kind of the, like, the face of, like, Macross products for a while. Like, one of them is even on a calendar, which is weird. One of the official...
On official Macross calendar?
Yeah, one of the official calendars. It's the Studio Hi-Fi YF-19.
Because nobody could draw a Valkyrie at that point anymore.
Well.
This is before Tengen, right?
Yeah, this should be, like, right before Tengen.
Yeah, I mean, there's no one. Like, Macross is dead at this point. Like, really, seriously. There is no one. Not even Kawamori is doing anything.
What? He designed the YF-30.
Games. They're making some games. The YF-30?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's now, though, right?
Oh, okay. You mean Macross is...
Like, that can't... We're talking... What was dead at that point? Yeah. Yeah, so it's kind of a weird time. Toys were still considered for kids, and the Studio Hi-Fi toys were kind of a transition between adult collector toys and kids, because you still have to put them together. But when you do, you know, they could transform and everything. They had screws and stuff.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a culture shock for Japanese people that there are completed toys,
mm-hmm.
models, that are sold in stores for adult collectors. So they used to import those. And at one point, Yamato just decided that they could find their niche within Japan by using a Japanese property. And they decided on Macross.
Okay.
It was kind of a mutual agreement between them and Big West. So they kind of went ahead and planned it together.
Hmm.
Kawamori was not involved at this time.
Interesting.
Again, because... That's because Macross was dead, so Big West was pretty much, yeah, we'll we'll take your money, do it, you know. And the risk factors were somewhat low because they knew that Macross was popular overseas. They'd done you know, their market research while they were importing the Spawn McFarlane stuff, and they talked to the overseas companies, so they knew that they could sell at least these robots to other countries.
Well, they were so hopeful at the time.
They planned on marketing that internationally from the very beginning. Do we have to go into the whole Toy-Con thing?
It was just a huge debacle, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Toy-Con was going to be the company, Toy-Con, the American company, was going to be the company that would sell their market, their products overseas.
Yeah, the first three being the Macross Plus toys, the original three.
Actually, they released them in the order of YF-19, YF-21, and VF-11C.
B.
The VF... B, right, yeah. The VF-11B was actually the first one that got made.
Okay.
Or rather, the first one that was designed. Which is weird, because I remember we all started looking at the VF-11B and thinking, oh, their designs are getting much better.
it's interesting because that one doesn't seem to be really based off of any prior figure.
Because there wasn't one, right?
Well, there was a Studio Half-Eye kit of it.
No, Half-Eye released it much later.
Okay. I think that explains it then.
I can't tell you exactly when right now. I could if I flipped through my my magazine. I'll probably do that afterwards. Yeah. But I remember the first two, the YF-19 and the YF-21, were very heavily based on the Studio Half-Eye kits, but the 11, there wasn't one at the time. So that's another interesting thing, actually, that Studio Half-Eye and Yamato were kind of still developing stuff in parallel.
Mm-hmm. That's basically ended what the Escaflowne figure.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
It was not a very beautiful ending.
This is kind of where we start off. We have their original sort of 1/72nd scale figures. The VF-11 is just sort of this weird quasi 1/72nd scale machine, but, you know, about the same size. A little bit, I think, smaller than a 1/55th, if I remember from my VF-11.
Yeah, well, officially it is a 1/72nd.
Hmm?
Scale. Yeah. Officially, it says 1/72nd scale, but you know, who knows with these things. And the proportions are so off.
And they have some really weird-ass name on the box, like Mechanical Transformer or something.
Macross Plus Mechanical Transformer.
Yeah.
Which I thought was cool at the time. I don't know why. Oh, I've got it here. Okay, so the VF-11 came out in 2001. I don't know exactly what point in 2001. The VF-11 Studio Half-Eye kit.
Oh, okay. All right.
And as did the other one, apparently.
Oh.
Yeah, but I'm sure the Yamato one came first.
Yeah, okay.
And they don't actually look like...
No, they don't. Not at all. So I only have experience with the VF-11 figure.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I never got either the YF-19 or the YF-21.
MacrossWorld.com was still very new at the time. I think the site opened in 99 and the forums opened in 2000.
Yeah.
So it's kind of... the history of Macross World has always been parallel to the history of Yamato as a company.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought it was very interesting that way. And so just before the first YF-19 toys started coming out, was about to come out, I was checking stuff on Macross World, and I was going, wow, this is a really great site. It's got lots of vintage stuff. But Graham kept posting news about the development of the 19 and all these things. And the first thing that struck me is the price. These things were hella expensive.
Yeah, were they like 7,800 yen? Or like at least $60 or so, like an American.
They went up to that, I think. Oh no, there were 7,140.
Okay. Pretty expensive for a toy.
Yes, but at the same time, let's see the. The VF-1 was 3,000 something, wasn't it? 3,800, something like that. With inflation, that's a lot more.
Yeah, the original VF-1 toy was like around 3,800 yen.
the
not that it really matters, but
the 165. Yeah, I mean they were never cheap toys. It's just I wasn't comparing it to a previous Macross toys or anything. It's just my idea of a toy just being so expensive was shocking because I wasn't a toy collector back then. And I knew that the Takatokus were astronomical in price just because they'd gone up in value. So I understood that. I just didn't know what was the value in this toy. You know what I mean? I thought, oh, great, they're making more toys. So it won't be ridiculously expensive like the Studio Hi-Fi, or it won't be, some vintage thing that you're paying a premium for.
Yeah.
And here they were, 7,000. I'm like, what the hell? And of course, I didn't read it in 7,000. I read it as like £100 sterling, you know. Or 200 or whatever it was. I don't know. So do you want to talk about each individual toy? I guess you didn't have a 19, but did you ever handle one?
Actually, no, I never handled either the 19 or the 21.
Okay. So I'll tell you my story, right? My story begins with the 21 because although I wanted to get the 19, I never had any opportunity to. We didn't have Hobby Link Japan in those days. We had eBay, but you know, it wasn't going to go down that road. Mm-hmm. And there was a guy on the forums who's not there anymore. His name was Swells because his name was Stephen Wells, and he just
I remember that guy.
Kind of truncated that. Oh, really?
Yeah.
He was Welsh. He was from Wales, and he had imported all of the Macross Plus toys that were out at the time, like the first two. And he said to me, I got a spare one, so I'll sell you a 21 if you want. And I'm like, yeah, great. And I remember I paid £50, which is what, like, maybe like $100.
Yeah, thanks.
Something like that. Yeah. And he sent it to me, and it was broken.
Oh.
And I'm like, what the hell, man? Sending me broken stuff. And he was like, I don't know, you can fix it.
Did you fix it?
I did, but it broke again, and then I told him it broke again, and then he gave me all these plans and blueprints. He actually drew drawings and gave me a list of parts to buy so I could fix
What was broken?
The shoulder sliders, they kind of split in the middle.
Oh.
Although I don't know... Yeah, it's kind of difficult to explain if you don't... Because it's nothing like the 160.
Yeah.
The 172 was the shoulder... things used to slide back when along this rail when you transform it into fighter mode.
Right. Well, I could always look at the Mark Tama website, Macross Tamashii, because he takes obsessed pictures of every toy. That's where I got all my 19 transformation pictures.
Oh, for the original?
Yeah.
The 172? Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, and the other thing was that when he sent it to me, it had this kind of blob of putty on top of the cockpit. And I was looking at it going, what the hell is this? And I realized he had sculpted his own VF-22 cockpit. So like, with the bubble cockpit. It was opaque, but it still looked quite accurate. So I thought that was kind of interesting, but it's still a YF-21 underneath.
Yeah.
So I quickly tore that off.
Huh. That's what.
And I said to him, I'm sorry, you know, I know you worked hard on that, but I think I'm going to break it off. And he said, you can do what you want. It's your toy.
Yeah, it's your toy now.
Okay. And, so I broke and fixed that so many times. And, And there was one point where I just said, oh, screw it, because one of my friends in university, I put it up on the display on my shelf, one of my friends in university said, oh, cool, Transformers, picked it up and, you know, smashed it and then put it back down and says, hey, let's go out to lunch. And I'm like, ass.
It was, I mean, the problem with that toy is that the Studio Hi-Fi kit wasn't really that good to begin with.
I know, yeah, there weren't. They weren't designed to be picked up and played with anyway, and I guess Yamato tried to kind of make the joints stronger or put diecast into parts where they needed, but still it wasn't enough. Oh, about diecast, though, apparently that was one of the things that they had in mind specifically for the overseas market. Again, the market research showed that people overseas liked diecast, you know.
Yeah, those people like are wrong.
Josh B. and all those old school collectors are all in the US and in Europe, and not really so much in Japan. Yeah. Like I said, the Chowokin Tamashii really hadn't taken off yet. So diecast really was not a big deal in Japan at the time. If you look at those stupid Transformer PVC toys. So diecast was useful for sturdiness, and also people overseas liked the heaviness of it. So the VF-19 really had a bunch of diecast. It was really, really heavy, the first one. They had diecast in some weird places as well, like the shoulders.
Yeah.
When they made a version 2 and they made the Blue Ravens version, they took that out.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that thing looks like really complex compared to the...
The 19?
The 160 toys. It seems very unintuitive.
I think... I don't remember very well, but I think the only difference is the way that the fuselage transforms. There's a panel that opens up so that the nose can constrict down.
Yeah, basically this part right at the top of the spine, where right before the chest,
behind the cockpit,
right before the chest plate, it's
kind of
sinks down inside the chest area, and also the hips, they push up to contract a little bit. The whole hip assembly.
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well, with that mold, I only had the blue one. And the reason for that is the previous. Well, it was that, but it was also that the previous two had just received such bad criticism on Microsoft.
Yeah, with Tab B, little Tab.
Tab B. Yes. There you go. So we're gonna be using these these kind of this terminology, like Tab B, and BP8 will come up later on.
Yeah, well, Tab B was just a thing that held it together, and it was right in the, I think, the chest plate and the dorsal panel that moved, and it would break constantly. So they made a new one where that part strengthened, so it wouldn't break.
Yeah, they made a version 2 or version 1.5 or whatever they called it. They actually put a sticker on the box this time.
I think I'll talk about my experience with the VF-11. Because I was at a little collector's convention. They had mostly Transformer stuff. And I was given the option to buy either one of the reissued Bandai Macross 7 toys or the VF-11. And even though I knew problems with the VF-11, I thought I could get it, loosen the hips a little bit, and it wouldn't break.
That's what I was told. You mean, like, unscrew the rear screws, right?
Yes. Because what happened with those toys is their hips are just put on big ball joints, just a pair of stocks sticking out of the sides of the plane. And the way they're assembled, it's basically a long plastic tube where they screw on the ball on the end. Mm-hmm. And I think that it was really hard to put those screws in because they were all over tightened and it would weaken the plastic even more. And it was a really bad gray plastic that just didn't want to stay together that much. So
yeah, it was pretty brittle.
So they would just kind of crumble. And I managed to fix it with some two-part resin, like an epoxy, but then it broke again.
Oh.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of fixes on Macrosworld. They had this guy who like used some kind of metal bar or something.
Well, that's interesting because when they made the Fast Pack version, it did have a metal bar inside where the hip was. So that's how they tried to fix it. But
I have both of those versions. The original non-Fast Pack version, the one that breaks... I decided to wait until I saw them cheap. I was in Japan at this point already. This is 2001. And I went to this very large hobby store. This is something I want to get back to afterwards, like where to buy Yamatos. Well, I went to this large hobby store in Kichijoji, which is gone now. It's a boxing gym now. Whenever they had new stock, they would put it in a pile just in the entrance of the store. And there was a pile almost as tall as I was, at least up to my chest, of just Yamatos.
Yeah.
And everything they'd released up until then. So they had the 21s, the 19s, and the blue 19s, that is. I think the original 19s were gone. Maybe they recalled them and repainted them. And the 11s. So I looked at them, and then I saw the price, and the 11s were going for 2,000 yen.
Yeah, yeah.
So back in those days, when they reduced things, I mean, they went for dirt cheap.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it was because of the criticism or whatever, but I said, yeah, I'll pick that up. And the box was huge.
Yeah, those boxes are...
It's gone... Why were they so wide?
Part of the problem is when you use a vacuum form plastic tray, it has to be big to protect the toy and shipping.
Right, but they obviously used a standard size box for all three of them.
Yeah,
and the 11 is significantly smaller than, let's say, the 19. In terms of like thinness, if you profile.
Oh, okay, okay. I see what you're saying.
If you stand it up from the side, then you can see that there's a whole bunch of empty space in
there.
Yeah,
it doesn't have a big mono boob like the YF-19.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, the 19 goes in way deeper. So actually, I use those boxes to store other stuff.
I have done that too. I put like books
behind
in there.
Toy, behind it.
Put Macross books in there.
Anyway, I took that out of the box and I loosened the screws immediately, and I got a good year or so out of that toy before they broke. But they broke, and they break sooner or later anyway. And I fixed it with super glue, and I think it's been fine since then. But I didn't really do much with it afterwards.
If those things had like one really other bad quality, was the way you attached the canopy cover with double-sided tape.
Right.
Because it...
Although it wasn't. I mean, didn't they have tabs that you could fold in?
They might have had tabs. I mean, you have to cut these things out of a little vacuum form piece of plastic. They give you two, just in case.
Yeah, just in case you screw it up.
So thoughtful.
Yeah, but I mean, at that point, we all thought that was an impossible transformation. I mean, we didn't know what was going to come in the future.
Well, Kawamura said that he didn't really design it to be made into a toy. Because he didn't think anyone wanted to make a toy that one. So,
which is kind of weird. Like the whole point in the 80s, the whole point of robot shows was to make toys, right?
Well,
the more robots you have, the only reason robots are in there is to sell toys.
Well, it's such a weird thing because so many 80s designs are not toy friendly. You know,
like what? Like?
Well, the Garland is not toy-friendly.
Oh, yeah. All right. No. So what I mean by that is, like, for TV shows.
Well, yeah, but I was going to say...
Because TV shows had like, sponsors.
Well, I mean, like, even, like, the Double Zeta Gundam or the Zeta Gundam are not toy-friendly. I mean, their toys are chunky and ugly, and because their designs rely a lot on, like, tiny little joints and stuff.
I think that what was happening at that point is that... You're transitioning out of relying on sponsors.
Yeah.
Because the sponsors would be the ones to pull the plug on the show if you didn't get enough ratings or you didn't get enough sales or whatever.
Yeah.
So they were starting to do other things.
Yeah.
Especially with Macross, you know, introduced the whole, hey, we can sell records instead kind of thing.
Yeah, records.
Anyway, that's another topic for another time.
Yeah. That's a topic we did with Richard.
That's true, yeah. Billy Wong. Do you know who Billy Wong is?
Billy Wong, yes, the sculptor of the original VF1 toys.
Except he's not.
Huh?
He's not really, though, because apparently he was just a name that they used. He does exist, but he was more like a supervisor of the team in China.
Okay.
Because they were all produced in China, right? I mean, it was Yamato's plan, but they basically commissioned sculpts. They told them what kind of features they should have, and they went over to China to the factory to check that everything was going right and to see if the prototypes transformed. And more often than not, they wouldn't transform. So then they would say, you know, it'd be trial and error, and it would go on for months and months, and they would say, you have to cut this by point whatever millimeters, and then they would develop another prototype, and then they would tell them to fix it another way.
Yeah.
So the pre-CAD days were pretty tough.
Yeah, that's one of the big things that really helped them as a company was computer-aided design. I like how on Yamato's page here they have a picture of the first VF1 toys they made, and it's missing the nose plug.
Oh, it's a big hole?
Huh?
There's just a big hole there.
Yeah, just a big hole there. Because with their first 160 scale VF1 toys, these were not perfect transformation. You had to take them apart and rearrange them to make them transform.
Hold and on. That wasn't actually announced until after we saw the photographs. Graham had been teasing that there was going to be a new mold after the Macross Plus toys. I thought that this was it, because I thought, how on earth are you going to improve the Takotoku? And they said, well, the next one is going to be VF1s. And I was like, I was totally not excited about this at all. Well, I was like, I have my perfect VF1. It's called the Takotoku 155. Why do I need this?
Yeah.
If they reissued that, I'd be happy. And of course, Bandai did just that.
Yeah.
But they said, yeah, we're going to make the VF1s. And first, on Macross World, they... I think Graham had to time it just right. He wasn't allowed to tease the pictures that he had until they'd been put up on the official site. I can't say. I've just got this advert for English conversation classes.
You'd be pretty good at that. Anyway.
Yes.
So he teased these in July of 01. And these were the first test shots. And they had three colors. They had, you know, Hikaru, Max, and Roy.
Yeah.
They look very nice, actually.
Well, I remember the forums were like, oh my god, the gun pods are collapsible! Whoa!
Well, they were.
Because we'd never seen... Yeah, because we never seen that. And now it's like a standard feature.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny to just reminisce about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you could mount the gun on the arm. That was the whole thing.
Right.
Which
they didn't have the strap yet, though, did they?
No, that was only on the 148.
Hmm.
So, this toy was the second modern Macross toy I had gotten after the 11.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the Max type, that's the only one I still have, from an HLJ sale. Because he was always the one to go on sale.
yeah, he was. I got, which ones did I get? I got the VF1A. Okay, I'll tell you a story. This is a story, right? I remember that I was in the UK when they were revealed, when Graham put up that photograph. And at first they were just silhouettes, right? People got excited just because of the silhouettes, because they looked a lot closer to the line art in silhouette form than the Takotokus ever did. I was expecting another blocky piece of shit. So when he put those up, people started talking, and then when we saw the actual photographs, people were amazed and were trying to figure out how they transformed. Because you didn't see any swing bars, they didn't say that the legs were removable. Some people said, no, obviously they're removable, you have to take them off and put them on. at the nose cone. And other people are saying, no, that's impossible because otherwise it wouldn't be a transformation toy, right? And to be fair, they never called them perfect transformation toys.
Yeah, you said they were
just
like...
If you look at the Japanese, there are Sandan Henke.
So...
And Sandan Henke means three-step transformation.
Yeah.
And if you actually talk to Yamato, they actually say that perfect transformation is actually a term that you need to get a license for. And they couldn't use, they weren't allowed to use the term to begin with.
Oh, wow, that's...
I don't know if that means that they weren't allowed to make a perfect transformation toy to begin with, or that they made this toy and they couldn't call it perfect transformation.
Hmm.
But whatever.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the whole licensing thing in Japan is so Byzantine. It's not, you don't get a Macross license. You know, people have spoken about how you have to get a license for this type of toy or a license for this scale or et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's also interesting that these are not any kind of like really standardized scale. They're 160, which is really just robots.
It's more about we want to make them this size. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's
make them
it's
the
always...
size comparable to the previous Macross Plus toys that we made.
Yeah. I've heard they wanted to make them 172nd, but they couldn't get it to work at that scale.
Yeah, no way. I mean, the reason that they couldn't make them perfect transformation is that they couldn't get it to work even at 160.
Right.
So, yeah. Anyway, this is the story, right? So I saw those when I was in the UK, but the following year, which is when they were due to be released, I went over to Japan just to do a study abroad, and there was this shop in Shinjuku called Sakuraya, which is gone as well. Everything's gone. That will be another theme that I'll talk about later, maybe. On the day of release, and this was going to be a monumental day, oh my god, the first VF1 toy for the new millennium. And I went there with at least one other guy. It may have been two. I think it was two. Two other people from Macross World. One of them was called Matt something. And the other one, I can't remember. I think maybe Noel Blackaces was in Japan at the time, but I don't think it was him. I think it was this guy called Min.
Okay.
But that wasn't his username. That was a real name. I can't remember anyone's username. Anyway... we went to Sakuraya, which is where you used to get these hobby, like collector-oriented toys.
Mm-hmm.
And as usual, they put them up on display in a big pile.
Mm-hmm.
So I was expecting the pile, but apparently they hadn't even put them up on display yet. The guy was bringing them out from the back of the store. So... I picked one up and I looked at it and I thought, yeah, I don't know. And then I started looking at what other consumers were doing, what the other customers going into the store were looking at. And there was a line forming,
mm-hmm.
You know, people were buying them and putting them other places. And if you go to the back of the shop at around this time, Bandai had already done their re-releases of the VF1J, the first VF155.
Oh, and that's what people were lucky enough to buy?
Yeah, people were picking up the Yamato, picking up the VF1J, and doing the kind of double take, you know, looking at one and looking at the other, and like, well, which one's better value for money, and which one's perfect transformation, which one's going to break faster? It was quite funny to look at these middle-aged Japanese guys, looking so confused. They're both VF1s.
They should be used to that, though, because they had tons of VF1s back then.
But not... They weren't released at the same time, though.
A couple.
These were, like, between months of each other. Really?
Well,
not
you had...
perfect transformation. I mean, not perfect, maybe, but not transformable ones.
Well, you would have, like, the smaller VF1 and the big one.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
It wouldn't really be a choice that you'd... I mean...
Yeah.
It was quite funny to look at what Bandai was doing, what Yamato was doing. Yamato was all about, let's see what we can do. And Yamato was like, and Bandai was like, oh shit, we can't fall behind Yamato. Quick, bring up those molds again.
Yeah. It's interesting though, because if there's one criticism that people level at Yamato a lot, is they tend to reinvent the wheel when they make a toy.
Right. Yeah.
Did they ever like study older toys or other toys to make their Macross stuff? Or
I mean, they must have looked at them.
Yeah.
But they went out. They actually specifically said that Takatoku was too high a hurdle to jump, so they knew that they wanted to do something completely new with the VF1.
Okay.
So in that sense, it was good for them to start with Macross Plus. That was another reason why. If they had started with the VF1, they probably wouldn't have gotten the fan base that they'd gotten. You know, I know I mentioned that the Macross Plus toys were criticized a lot for just, you know, some shoddy construction and poor engineering. But at the end of the day, they were recognized for doing what they were doing.
Because they were the first toys of these characters.
Yeah, I mean, there was no Macross Plus product at all. Unless you include the
garage
soundtracks.
Or garage kits.
Or garage kits, yeah.
Yeah.
So when they finally got around to doing the VF1, they wanted to do something that nobody had done before. And I guess getting rid of the swing bar was kind of their way of... And adding posability, you know, like the hip joint,
yeah,
the waist swivel. You know, whether that was a success or not, at least they looked like more modern Macross toys. They did look closer to the cartoon. But yeah, even at that point, they had started to see the limitations of designing, sculpting everything by hand. So they wanted to move on to CAD as soon as possible, even when they were doing the VF1 line. So they were going over to China to look for better factories and talk to better designer companies. Just one more thing.
Okay.
At around this time, they were told by other industry people that they were quite brave to be making mecha and robots.
Oh,
because you know the figures, you know, human character figures are fairly easy to make. You don't need such complex mechanisms and things. But these, they cost a lot of money to produce. Engineering is tough, and you know, nobody really wanted to follow in their example, make new things. That's another reason why Bandai just brought out the old molds, you know?
Yeah, that's sort of like one of the things that people don't realize is that mecha
really
is like
an
investment.
Yeah, it's really, really risky.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, I was just going to ask you, what was your impression of the toy?
Of the VF1?
Yeah, like overall.
Well, I didn't buy it that day. So overall, I was like, this is too expensive for what this is. And I actually bought, not on that day, but I think it was a birthday present from my ex-girlfriend, the VF1J from Bandai. I mean, I hadn't had a 155 since Jetfire.
Yeah.
So that's the one I really wanted. I was really excited about that.
Yeah.
And Macross still was a nostalgia thing for me.
Yeah.
You know, I like Macross Plus and everything, but the original Macross was nostalgia or nothing.
Right.
You know, I didn't care that these were more posable. It wasn't about that to me. It was about playing with the toys that I used to play with as a kid, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it was probably different markets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I did get the VF1s. I got two or three. I got three. Just because they were cheaper. I got the VF1A when it went down in price at that same store.
Mm-hmm.
I took it out of the box at home, and the head was kind of molded into the neck so it couldn't transform. It had like melted together somehow. I don't know how. So you couldn't move the head at all. They were packaged in fighter mode, right?
Yeah, they were.
Yeah, and the head.
I'm trying was to picture how that could happen, but
it was just a blob of white plastic underneath the neck.
Huh.
So you.
Is this like the start of your terrible luck with Yamato toys?
Yeah, the very first one.
Okay.
Well, the start was the YF-21. You know, it came broken, but I guess that was secondhand, so I kind of accepted it. So I took it right back to the store, and they didn't even ask me. I said, there's something wrong with this. They didn't open it, they didn't look at it, they didn't do anything. They just put it behind the counter and gave me another one. I don't even remember if they asked to see my receipt. And I posted that on the boards as well. I remember just saying, you know, the guy must have done this so many times, and Yamato must have such a bad reputation for just bringing out bad products. So they were, again, they were criticized for more quality control things. And I think some of it is fair, but some of it is like, I don't know if some people on the boards maybe think that quality control is kind of like a dial that you just dial up.
Well,
we have to increase the quality control, and that's not really how it works.
Well, I think also a problem is they like to conflagrate like a design flaw with quality control. That's like,
yeah,
you don't get two left hands as quality control.
Yeah,
you know, a bad design is just, you know, a bad design. You can't really up the dial and fix the bad design.
Exactly.
Without a whole new toy.
Well, in this case, it was quality control. It was just either assembled wrong or something happened. I don't know what it was. There was a lump of plastic where it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And then after that, I got... do you remember there was a Toys R Us exclusive?
Yeah, the slightly different brown version of the brownie.
Yeah, the brown one that they released first was, I think, more of a brown color, and the other one is more of a tan color. Anyway, the first one was the Toys R Us exclusive, and I went because I got some other Macross World members asking me to get one, and that they would pay later or something. And, you know, that was one of the few times that I actually bothered to do stuff like that. But that has never, ever worked, you know? They say they pay, and then they say, oh, I don't want it anymore, or whatever. Anyway, this time, I went over, and they'd all sold out by the time I got there. I had to work in the morning, I think, and I got there in the afternoon, and they were all sold out, so I didn't get any. But then months later, I saw one in Amandarake, and it was cheaper, so I just got it there. And, yeah, that was okay, I guess. And then the Max, I just got it because it was cheap. I found it in some other tiny shop that is not there anymore again.
Yeah. You guys can read my review on Collection DX of the old Max VF1A type. I have a soft spot for the figure. I mean, it's got some weird design choices. I'm not really against the whole removable leg thing because that's how the VF1 transforms.
Yeah, at the end of the day, they do remove, which is nothing that I've ever liked, really. I always thought it was stupid that, hey, look, the engine, we're just going to detach the engines from the plane.
Well, they swing on that little
That's the
panel.
Stupidest thing ever. I know.
But it's so funny because people are like, they didn't know it was in the show, but it'd be like, here's a screen cap for episode one.
Yeah.
Here's another one from the last episode. It's like it was there all along. But
it was, but I'm sorry, it's stupid.
I know. That's why the VF0 doesn't do it like that.
That's stupid too. It's just a tiny little, it's a Ban Presto inspired transformation.
Yeah.
Although it's funny that the Yamatos don't transform like that.
No, they don't.
Whatever.
Yeah. Again, I think it would have been interesting if they had the later waist design, not what they had originally, like where it's one little bar that has connects both legs. It kind of goes into the nose. and not the plug-in method, because they don't really plug in. They just sort of rest in there with only friction keeping them in on the original 160.
Yeah, yeah.
And also you have to take parts off and put them away.
Yeah, yeah, and that's another thing that really annoyed me.
Yeah. You had to take the little plug out of the nose and then swap the canopy with the heat shield.
Yeah, but there were Macross World members who fixed at least the heat shield thing.
Yeah, that one guy who completely redesigned the interior to make the heat shield part of the thing.
Full C?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. He also made articulated hips for the VF... for the 155.
Yeah. Because that's what a lot of guys did. They took bootlegs of the 155 and tried to give them more articulation.
5 buck milk.
Yeah.
From VF1XS.
Yeah.
Jerry.
If there's one thing I always am amazed by when I pick that toy up is that it's heavy as hell.
Which one?
The one.
The VF1, the 160.
Yeah, the first 160s. Because
it is, yeah. The whole leg is die-cast, even the upper part. Even the thigh.
Yeah, and it's kind of useful for, you know, balancing it, but it's just like...
Yeah.
You could kill somebody with those legs.
Yeah, I mean, they were quite sharp as well.
Yeah. Well, the nose was really sharp on that toy. People used to joke it had a needle nose.
Oh, I remember what happened to my Max version. I put it on the bookshelf, and next to it I had all these Macross books, and the gold book was right next to it.
Uh-oh.
I don't know what happened. I knocked it over, and it completely crushed the toy. Yeah, crushed by the gold book.
That's ironic.
Yes. So the tail fins broke.
Yeah. Mine, the head laser broke because I had it on my bed, and I was going to write a review about it, and it fell off the bed. And I glued it back on, and it stayed on for a long time, even through the video review I did of the toy.
Yeah. Yeah, so every Macross Yamato toy up until that one really had their Achilles heel, you know? It was the stupid tab B for the 19, the shoulder sliders on the 21, the hips on the 11, and this one really was okay. It was the first one that didn't have any problems.
Yeah. It just had some like weird design issues, like you can't raise
the
arms without dislodging the chest.
Yeah. Because the other thing that was happening was that Toynami had formed and was starting to bring out their own masterpiece, right?
That was a little bit later.
That was later?
I think that was around when the 148 came out.
Yeah, that was it. Right? Yes, you're right. Yeah. Because they used design cues from Yamato as well, the 160.
Yeah. But we'll get into that.
But anyway, no, what I was going to say is that this time, a lot of companies started making VF1 toys, and the consumer had a lot of choice.
Yeah.
So for the 160s, I think Bandai and Yamato, it was still a tough choice for a consumer that really only wanted one.
Yeah. It was interesting, though, that they made a lot of accessories for their toy. They made armor for it, the full armor. They made the super packs for it, although you needed to have one that came with the packs.
I think they never planned for that originally.
No. Although, if they were really clever, they could have used magnets on the legs, at least. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the later ones had little slots cut out in the arms and holes.
Or maybe they just wanted you to buy them again.
Well, they were going to offer at one point upgrade kits for the previous ones so they could have fastbacks. Yeah. Like new legs and new arms. You could just, you know...
But that would be like a whole new toy, though.
No, they would just do the lower legs. It's like the minimum amount of parts you need to change it over.
You'd have to unscrew a bunch of stuff. Because remember, they had the screw covers as well.
Yeah, those damn screw covers. But, you know, I think they thought the customers
can't see them asking the consumers to do that.
Well, no, I think they were, like, offering either, like, parts or, like, full legs and arms you could, like, pop off or something.
Okay.
I'd have to like dig and find that picture of what they were going to offer, but yeah, they were going to do it.
Yeah, I don't remember that. Okay, well, like I said, around this time they had already seen that this really was the limit of hand-sculpted design. And they made as many as they could VF1 variations. They went and redid the whole Skull Squadron in fastpack form, right?
They only did Fokker's Valkyrie in fastpack form.
Really? They didn't do the other two?
No, they had a prototype for the 1As, but they never did them.
Yeah, because you're right. Because then they made the TV show Valkyries, yeah.
Yeah.
With fastpacks.
Which was kind of weird because they were more following the footsteps of the models, and they did a Super Hikaru type TV show version.
Exactly, yeah.
Which there's model kits of that, but there's never in the show.
Yeah. And I always found the sculpt of the Super Packs kind of strange. They're kind of hexagonal.
You mean from the front or from on the like the
left? Yeah, from the front, yeah.
On the like I can see it.
The boosters, the top ones.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that's part of the design, but they kind of got it a little wrong there.
I never had those though.
Yeah, I had one. I had the Hikaru type. No, I had the Hikaru and the Max type. So, the packs went on all right. The one awkward thing though was the fact that because the toy still had the tab to slide the fist out, that gets covered by the fast pack. So you actually line up a new tab over that one, and it never really worked to get both of them to move at the same time, and it never worked that
you
right.
Tab the tab into the tab so you can slide the tab.
Yes. It was funny because they want you to put it like over the tab. It's like, why don't you just have it like behind the tab to push it? But it's like, no, that would be too fragile or something. Yeah, I mean, they were all right. The packs were all right. They also made the switch over to the new style of gun pod attachment where the handle would collapse inward. To get the handle off the ground. Because on the original ones, the gun pod attached after you took off these weird little slices out of the arm.
Yeah, that was another piece that you had to keep somewhere. Were tiny, sharp shards of plastic.
Or you could have just like left them off because it doesn't really change the aesthetics that much.
Yeah, you're right.
But yeah, that was kind of weird too. Also, they had the antenna for Kerouac mode.
Although I think that I liked the idea that they included the antenna because I think that a lot of people completely forgot that that was part of the design. Certainly, you didn't see it in many model kits.
No, you didn't. You didn't see it that much on the show either.
Yeah, yeah, like episode one.
Yeah, I think I remember it mostly from the movie where when Hikaru lands his VT-1 on Earth, you can see the antenna bouncing around.
Oh, the antenna kind of flails about a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was interesting, the antenna. Because you got two, I think, didn't you? Like a spare one?
Yeah, you got two antennas and you got two nose plugs, just in case. You got the extra hand for holding the gun. Pod that had no thumb.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the other thing.
Well, I don't know why it has no thumb. That would have been the perfect question, though, to ask them.
But I remember the other guy, Min, the guy that I went to Sakuraya with that day, later that year, Banpresto released their own tiny VF1 that was supposed to be prizes for a UFO catcher kind of game machine things.
Yeah, I still have some of those.
I still have one.
Yeah.
They break, though.
Well, yeah, prize games. Prizes.
If you look at their removable hands, aren't the thumbs really oddly long? They're overly long.
Yeah, that is
thumb is
true.
Like an extra middle finger.
Yeah,
I remember him posting saying, because he was in Japan, he was always getting these prizes, he was very good at the game or whatever, and he was the first one to get one, and he posted his review, or his impressions at least, and he said, I know where the Yamato thumbs went.
Yeah, they wanted the little toy. They were stolen. The only reason I can think it doesn't have the thumb is because they might have tried to mold it like that, and they would break off.
Yeah.
Or something went wrong there. So, one guy I know on Toybox DX, he cut into the other hand that holds the gun pod, the one that does retract. He just cleaned off a lot of plastic from the on the finger to get the index finger to like bend a little bit into the trigger grip.
I see.
So he also shaved some plastic from the inside of the shoulder socket so it could move a bit more and actually point forward without dislodging the shoulders.
Yeah, that was another thing. That the shoulder, the chest plate was too wide.
Yeah.
Well, and it impeded the.
Yeah. Well, it's weird because that thing has like three places where it locks in. So it's kind of like this is stupidly redundant. Because I had a VT1 where, it fell off my shelf, and one of the little tiny tabs inside the hinge for one of the arms broke. But it didn't matter because those arms always locked into place in so many different places when it was when I transformed it. So it always stayed where it needed to be. So
okay, so you've got the list in front of you, right, of all the amount of toys and everything?
Yes.
So is there anything they didn't make in this line? They made pretty much everything, didn't they?
In the old ones?
I mean, they made even the VT1 and V1 and...
They didn't do Kakazaki's, either of them.
Oh, that's true.
Didn't really do a lot of TV stuff.
They didn't do TV Kakazaki. They didn't do Angel Birds.
No.
They didn't do movie Kakazaki. Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I guess fans of Skullscorn kind of got...
They were very movie-oriented, mostly.
And then they had the Quedlon Rao, or Quadron Law, if you pronounce it in katakana.
Yes.
The female power armor.
Yeah, I have that toy. It's all right. It's a big plasticky thing, but it does what it needs to do.
I've never handled one. I always thought it was just too expensive. I would have gotten it if it was half the price.
Well, I got mine at half price.
Oh. Well, there you go.
I had heard a rumor that when they did their second issue of those toys that the factory overproduced them and was selling them on the side. So that's why they flooded the market.
They were everywhere.
Yeah.
If you went to any store, you could see them.
Yeah.
Which is strange because I never saw them cheap enough for me to get. I always saw them, but at full price, and that's why they weren't shifting.
Yeah. Well, because the first one had the little figure. And you could,
you could
also buy the CM's Corporation figure, which could go in there.
Because they made they made an articulated one that could go in there as well.
No, it wasn't articulated. It just had swappable bodies.
Really?
Yeah, it was just three fixed
pose. Okay, I don't know what I'm talking about.
It was three fixed pose Amelia figures. One with...
Oh, one with a wedding dress.
Yeah.
And another which is more detailed.
Yeah, more detailed pilot figure than one just standing with her pilot suit.
Right.
But they only had two heads between them, between all three. So one had to be headless.
That set was like 3,000 yen or something like that, and I remember seeing it for half price and still thinking about it for half price because swappable heads. I mean,
yeah.
Come on, man.
Yeah,
and then they made the max figure.
Somewhere in here, there's also the VB6, the caning monster.
Yeah, the VB6 came out after, though, because you have to... They did the 148 before that.
Oh, okay. So let's talk about the 148, then.
Those are larger scale. Yeah, so 148 was, like I mentioned before, the VF-160 line was really the limit of what they could do with those hand-sculpted molds. And I think a lot of the reasons why even though they did a lot, even up to and including the VF1D, the reason why they didn't do a lot of the minor things, such as Kakizaki and Angel Birds, is probably because the mold had already deteriorated to the point that they couldn't use that mold anymore.
Mm.
As soon as they got their CAD skills down and they got this new factory and new engineering team, they brought out the 148. And my impression was that I was in Japan at the time when this was revealed, because they did it at the Tokyo Toy Show in 2002. And Sean and Graham actually came over to Japan at around this point in time to see this.
The mythical Sean.
Mythical Sean. Mythical Graham as well. Though.
Yeah.
The Toynami Masterpiece collection had been out by this point as well. And I remember that we went over to the Tokyo Toy Show, and they had set it up so that it was kind of the inside of a hangar bay. And so you had these Valkyries in fighter mode and in Batroid mode. And you had all these...
I remember that. Like little staff tractors and...
Little cars. And
yeah.
Lots of wires going into the mechanics and everything. And it was really, really impressive. I remember seeing photographs of it before... In like the month before, I guess, or maybe a couple of weeks before.
Mm-hmm.
And people, again, were wondering, how does this transform? Because we'd already been told it was perfect transformation, no part swapping whatsoever, no heat shield swapping, no leg swapping. And a lot of people were baffled. And I remember there was this one guy called MSV or something like that,
mm-hmm.
Who either became a toy designer or was a toy designer. His mecha designs were pretty good. He had some interesting concepts, but it involved like opening up. We saw this diagonal seam that goes across the fuselage, just underneath the cockpit.
Yeah,
and people are thinking that opens.
Yeah,
that opens up to reveal some kind of sliding gear or rolling gear that. Returns the.
You can find a lot of these on the Macross World contest page, because they had a contest for designing transformation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was before this came out, though.
Yeah.
So that was basically how to improve the 160, yeah?
Yeah.
And this was more about the, let's try and see if we can reverse engineer this thing just by looking
at it. Well, I remember one of them being similar to that, where it kind of split open the nose cone and then it slid forward and then closed again.
Well, again, I could be confused and might just be thinking of that.
Yeah. So
I remember there was one where the whole, you know the Skull Squadron stripe that goes across with the UN Spacey logo in the middle of it?
Yeah.
That just being a bar, that being the sliding bar that it kind of pops out and then you turn it upside down and then pop it back in, and that would be the leg transformation. If you did that, the
numbers
the
would be
UN
wrong.
Spacey logo would be upside down and the numbers would be wrong. It still looked okay, I guess, though.
Well, there was also one where that just slid into the nose, that whole area, somehow.
Huh. Yeah. There's a lot of anime magic there. Yeah, so that was really impressive. And I remember we all had dinner that night celebrating the triumph of Yamato even before the MPC. Because the MPC, the Masterpiece Collection BF1 by Toynami, I think still hadn't actually come out yet.
No, there was a lot of delays with it.
Or had.
You know, big surprise.
But we'd seen a lot of photographs of it, though.
Yeah.
And I remember my comment was, NPC, you died before you were born. Because this really showed, it was a difference between night and day, really. The NPC had been shown in some toy shows in the US, and if you remember, the display of it just sitting on a table in fighter mode, and the leg completely bent. because it would bend under its own weight or something. I don't know what the hell the problem was. It was just awful. And we had dinner that night, and everyone had checked Macross World that previous afternoon. And someone, I think it was VF1X or maybe XO or someone, had posted this this picture of... Maybe it was a model kit, or maybe they photoshopped the NPC or something. I don't know what it was. They called it the NPC version 2, where they had just mistransformed it, and the leg was completely bent at the knee, and there was a giant no-step sign on the wing.
Yeah, that was
like literally written right across.
He customized a 150th bootleg.
Yeah, that was it.
Into this horrible mess with giant no steps on the wing, one big one, just one big one. Like, we're not going to have little ones; we're just going to have one big one.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah. So.
And I remember just having dinner and Sean going, "Yeah, did you see the NPC version 2?" And I was like, "Yeah, I saw that." And he was like, "Man, we were crying in the hotel room, crying."
Well, I think it's also important to point out that the NPC is very clearly based on the HCM toy.
Yeah, it's a mixture between the HCM, the 155, and the Yamato.
Yeah. Well, the thing that it copies from the Yamato is the tail fin thing.
Yeah.
The way they get the tail fins to full flush by having asymmetrical hinges on the tail fins.
But it also had light-up LED eyes.
Which is a really bad idea unless you paint the interior of the head. Because it'll make the whole head light up.
The whole head. Shoot here.
And you can't turn the neck all the way because of the wires.
Right.
Because they run down into the...
So how does it transform then? That's what I never understood. Or can you only turn it one direction or something?
You can only turn it like one direction. Yeah, only one direction.
Right, that's it. Okay.
So... And also, somehow, the first NPC... had no diecast.
Oh.
And the subsequent ones did. Which is like, you can't have that happen unless you made two sets of molds.
So what do you think happened with that?
I don't know. I'm pretty sure you can't just like have a mold and have it do both diecast, and you can't do that.
Mm.
It's a totally different process to make the both of them. So... It was like, that's shady as hell. But anyway, let's talk about a good toy.
Well, that whole company. 148. Yeah, I mean, again, I didn't get one, but that was more about timing, I think, just because I had got back to the UK before they actually released them.
Yeah.
So the first one I got was the low-vis Valkyrie. And the reason for that was that I already had the other colors. I wasn't a completist. I didn't want a whole Skull Squadron. I didn't have the money or the space. So I figured if I was just going to get one, then I'll get this.
So you actually own the mythical low vis?
Yeah, I have it here somewhere.
I actually did. Right, I got one. I got the first one they released, the Hikaru 1A type.
Yeah.
I still have it, too.
Yeah, I mean, we all thought that... Okay, well, maybe it was just me. If you look at the packaging, it's completely different, right? So, black box with a flip-top lid thing. And it was obviously designed to, you know, with the little squiggles and everything, designed to invoke... a classier, kind of more premium kind of toy, display piece.
Yeah.
And I thought that these were just premium versions of the 160 line. And not to say that they were upscale or anything, I knew what they were about, but I didn't think that they would do a full line. I thought maybe they would do Skull Squadron and call it a day.
Yeah.
Because I didn't think that people existed to support that as a market, you know what I mean? I didn't think there would be actual collectors that would get every one.
Yeah. Well, this is where the market started to take off, really.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, the timing was good, too. I mean, you had all sorts of other companies starting to get into the high-priced mecha toy genre.
Yeah.
Like The Masterpiece Transformer came out at the same time as well. Masterpiece Convoy.
Yeah.
That was 2003, I think.
Masterpiece Convoy was 2002, I believe.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
So it was the same time then.
Yeah.
But it was after the 148, at least after the first one.
Oh, okay. I think it was 2002. Anyway. So these toys were huge.
Yeah, but for their size, they were very light because they didn't have any die-cast apart from the swing bar.
Yeah. But they felt very solid. They had a lot of ratchets in the right place.
Yeah.
Everything locked together, but you could transform it fairly easily. You could do the most important thing, which is to swing the legs forward from fighter mode, which the 160 could not do.
Because you had to detach them from the front, from the air intake part.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of weird.
Yeah. You know, you could put the gun pod on without taking off any random panels. They kept that from the second 160 revision. Uh-huh. Weird little collector's things, like you could take the nose cone off and there's a crappy panel inside that's supposed to be the radar.
Yeah, I don't know. I know you don't need that, but that's one of the things that I guess Yamato said, okay, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it. We're going to go all out, you know what I mean? Have the radar, have the pilot be removable, have the cockpit open to begin with, because they didn't do that before either. I guess they did that with the 172 Macros Plus Valkyries.
Well, with the 160s, they didn't have pilots at first.
Yeah.
And then eventually.
Well, neither did the Macros Plus ones to begin with. Yeah. They did.
But they added pilots eventually, and they were little like half pilots.
When they did the fast packs, right?
And it had like.
And the air brake.
Yes.
And the antenna was not a removable piece. It was built into it, so you could pull it out and pull it in.
Yeah. And the flaps and the wings move, although they move as one unit, but still kind of a nice touch.
Yeah, no, that was really impressive for me. So I actually did see the value in that, even though it was twice the price of...
One good thing, though, is that all the wheels move. All the landing gear wheels move.
Right. I mean, we really take it for granted now, but back in the day, you know,
on the 160, the nose wheel didn't move at all, but the two main wheels in the back did move. Which was weird.
Yeah, and then you had people in Macros World saying, "Well, what do you want to roll it around for? It's not a car."
Well, you have to taxi that before you take off.
Yes,
your airplane
doesn't fly either. If it flew, I wouldn't complain. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And also, interesting thing is that it had the built-in side covers, which nobody remembers to use because they're kind of fidgety.
Well, I don't know if they're side covers as much as they are stabilizers for the or connectors for the back plate and the front plate.
Well,
side covers invokes more of the panels that came afterwards with the armor and everything.
Yeah, that's true.
It does fill in a bit of the gap, but it just looks like some piece of plastic.
Yeah. Well, they don't actually really help to keep it together. All that much.
No, I think that was a bit of a misstep in the design process. I don't know what happened there. They don't... I have three. No, I have four 148s. And they're all slightly different in that area. Some of them connect, some of them don't.
Yeah.
Some of them stay together, some of them don't.
Although, one good thing about the design, too, is in addition to that magic swing bar, which blew our minds, that's like... Oh, it's under the arms and can connect and just swings out with the wing.
It turned out to be so simple.
Yeah.
You know?
It was kind of staring us in the face. But what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, you actually still had a waist joint, too. A little bit, yeah. Yeah.
And, of course, if you try to use it, side panel things...
Yeah, they get knocked out.
Detached.
But one good thing about the design is that it was made with the fast packs in mind.
Except it wasn't.
Well, it had all the slots for them.
Yeah, it had all the slots, but they really did focus on just the gimmicks of the main toy. And this is something I heard from Yamato. When they actually brought it out, they said, okay, so the next step is fastbacks. What are we going to do? They actually hadn't... I mean, to a certain extent, they figured out how they would attach it. But during the actual engineering process, they realized that they should have gone in a different direction. And I didn't ask them to elaborate any more on that. But I can kind of guess that it's related to the BP-8, right?
Yeah, yeah. Because that's kind of the Achilles heel of the backpack connection. Is
that the top fast packs are way too heavy for that tiny hinge that it all rests on.
Yeah. I mean, I never actually had the fast packs. I know they come with a little part that stabilizes the backpack. And holds it up. But other than that, I mean, the fast packs for it were... Because they had all the removable panels. They were of comparable quality to the 148 Club Ebb kit. You had removable missiles. You could change out the booster for the strike cannon.
You know what? You know the moment that I thought, okay, these Macross... these Yamato guys are really, like, hardcore. The moment I thought that was when I looked at the... sticker sheet for the fast packs, and there is a tiny, tiny, puny sticker
of a Budweiser.
That is the Budweiser label,
and the octopus highball.
I don't think they had that sticker, or maybe they did.
I think they did.
I have to go back and check. Really?
Yeah, and you could put them on the missiles, just like in the movie.
If anyone listening to this has never seen the movie, or does not, or hasn't seen that frame of the movie. In the climax of the movie, just before Hikaru enters the room where
he's flying down the trench.
Yeah, shooting missiles. That's really the climax in terms of animation, right? Because that scene goes on for a long time,
and a couple of missiles fly in front of the screen. If you freeze frame it, you can see the big Budweiser can missile. Which is so expertly drawn, it's kind of scary. And
I mean, that's Itano.
Yeah, that's probably Itano. That was Itano.
And he likes putting those things in there because, Megazone Part 2. He's got the Heineken cans and all these things everywhere.
All the Heineken cans.
And free product placement.
Yeah, and also the Octopus Highball missile you see, like, afterwards.
Yeah.
So
those are in the movie. Yeah. Therefore, our canon... Is that canon? Oh my god, it's canon.
So our toy has to have it.
Yeah, that was amazing. And each individual missile...
Can come off and get lost in the carpet.
Yeah, were they all individuals, or were some of them on a run?
I think...
Because I'm getting confused now with the later 160s, because those were all stuck together.
Yeah, the later 160s are just molded details that are painted.
Oh, I know. They had different types. They had some which were two.
Okay.
Two missiles stuck together, and some which were just one.
Okay.
So I'm talking about the tiny missiles that go inside the fast packs, the shoulder.
On the big boosters.
Yeah. Yeah, on the backpack. Yeah. Then apart from that, you could take off the covers for the lower leg fast packs as well to see some... detail there.
Yeah. It also came with the reaction missiles, which is a cool thing.
But they never stayed on.
Yeah. Well, we also take that for granted, too, that the Yamatos, they standardized the whole idea of underwing pylons. I mean, the High Complete model had those, too, but nobody had that toy, so nobody remembered it.
Yeah, they never reissued it.
Yeah. Oddly enough, the 160 scale armor packs came out in between all this in 2004.
Yeah.
For the first 160. You could get either a bundle or a separate release. And
The boxing gloves.
Oh, yeah, the huge, the big clown hands.
Mickey Mouse, yeah. Yeah. Those looked awful, and they were awful. They all fell apart.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it was quite obviously engineered after the fact.
I have that set. The only good thing about it is that it will fit the any 160. You don't need to have...
You mean the newer ones?
Huh?
Not the newer ones, though, surely.
Oh, no, no. Yeah, it'll fit any of the old 160s.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't need to have the ones that are only made for the super packs. So...
Right,
it doesn't
right.
use any slots that the later ones have.
No.
Like the back boosters attached by friction. They just sort of sandwich between the two. The backpack, more or less.
Okay.
Yeah. They also had their Macross stand, which is like the best stand they will not reissue. Sadly.
Yeah, but they made a lot of those.
Yeah.
They reissued those a number of times, and for some reason they always sell out, so...
Yeah. And then finally we get the armor packs for the 148, which is where we kind of learn... We run into a bit of a problem with the design of the 148. The Achilles fin, I will call it.
Uh-huh.
So here's a weird like detail that nobody really noticed. That fin on the legs on the VF1
yeah.
is supposed to fold... for the armor packs to go around. Because if they
it's
don't...
supposed to... You mean in the original design, or...?
Yeah.
Oh, how do you mean?
A couple times you see them folding. I think you do see them fold out again when he ejects the armor in the show.
Oh, okay.
I know they fold when he does his re-entry in episode 27. They wiggle a bit. So that wasn't that was intentional. So... If those don't fold, you have to make the armor go around them.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes the leg armor really big, which means that the proportions of the rest of the armor have to be big to match it. Which is really my complaint with the old 148 armor, is that it's more like hockey pads than, you know, just armor. It's like super bulky.
It does impede a lot of the... posability, all of the movement for the limbs.
I think all the missiles come out of it too, can be detached, which, you know,
yes,
means that, you know, you can lose them. I think they might have had.
Well, they do give you extras.
Yeah, they give you extras so you don't lose them.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool and impressive. One thing I kind of missed about is that you can only buy the armor to get, or at the time you can only buy the armor to get the. Closed fists that were during the glove style. The closed fist and the fixed pose shooting hand or the open palm hand with the blocky Do You Remember Love style. Because that's one thing that the 148 really failed at was its internal hands.
Yeah.
The chicken hands.
So-called chicken hands,
Because they have that offset pinky, which is in the design but not in the movie. Which is yeah, because if you have your Commodore design works, you can look at or go to the Macross Mecha Manual. It has a little like offset pinky on the VF1's hand, but in the show, it's like just you know regular. It's like you know the flat back of the hand and then just all the fingers.
Oh, you mean it's in the movie, but it's not in the TV show?
No, I mean there's a difference between how he designed the movie hands and how they're animated in the movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they don't actually use. That design in the movie. Well, anything to give me another excuse to watch the movie.
Well, just watch the scene where Hikaru grabs Minmay as she's falling, and then look at your design works or the Mecha Manual picture.
Okay.
All right. But anyway, so that design didn't really work.
I think that the hands... Well, I don't know about the VF1, but hands are usually designed by Miyatake. At least the VF19 and VF17 were.
Okay, so... But they're in the Cowboy.
Well, whatever. Yeah.
they're in that book. I will say they're in that book anyway. But that weird, just you know, offset pinky thing, they made it curl differently than the regular fingers. Like, because usually with poseable hands, you have the index finger moves by itself, and the three fingers underneath are fused. On the 148 and a lot of their toys after this, you had a movable thumb, movable index finger. Two fingers fused, and this weird, like, tiny pinky that didn't look right, It didn't really do.
It looks like a hook.
Yeah, it looks like a hook. It doesn't do anything other than get stuck somewhere constantly. So that was.
Yeah, it was annoying, but I could see that because their reference material was probably just that Kawamori Works book.
Yeah, exactly. And that was kind of part of the problem, is that line art is the beginning of design, not the end of it.
Right.
Yeah. But we finally
got. But you know, at the same time, the consumers, they also want it to be line art accurate, you know? Not always screen accurate.
Well, I know, but so I guess the problem is, it's like we saw that there was that one of the Making of Macross documents that came out with Newtop Ace, where there's different line art for the VF1 Battleroy mode.
Yeah.
Where it's more, you know, like the fighter mode is, not chunky and out of proportion.
Well, the reason for that is that he had to draw different line art for different purposes. One is for TV show appearances, and the other one is for Takatoku to have something to refer to in the toys.
Right, but that's kind of the...
He was...
Yeah.
I mean, Kawamori was working... That's another big difference, that Kawamori was working in conjunction with Takatoku.
Yeah.
So that they could make the best product.
Yeah.
And that's why it was a success, you know, like we talked about previously.
Well, my point...
But in Yamato's case, they hadn't had any input from Kawamori whatsoever up to this point until they did the VF1. The
VF0.
148.
Oh, the 148.
No, the 148.
Okay.
So that's something I'm going to talk about next.
Okay.
But you can say your thing.
Well, I was going to say that, I mean, the fact that that existed, though, means that we didn't have the full picture of the design, you know? Like, we just knew that this was the artwork they always had. And they put in every book and whatever. But with Gundam,
okay.
The original RX-78 has been updated and redesigned a lot over the years.
Right.
But the VF1 has never really had that, you know?
Mm.
So it's kind of like you can get the perfect mechanical, you know, image of the RX-78 without being accurate to the old Okawara line art.
Right.
So that's kind of like the difference here, is that they have more leeway with the design.
That's true. It's open for many interpretations.
Yeah.
Hmm. But what happened with this toy is that whereas previously... Kawamori was not involved whatsoever and probably didn't even know about these toys coming out or care. They said let's have a meeting with Kawamori about what he thinks would be good for this toy. And so people from Yamato used to meet Kawamori and go up to him and show him these VF1 toys. They said, we're going to make the ultimate toy, and so we'd really like your opinion. Where could we improve this and that? And at first, Kawamori really wasn't that interested. He didn't know what they were going to bring over and show him. They probably thought it was some weird, shitty toy. And apparently he was really impressed with the 148, even some early prototype. He'd never seen the VF1 transform in this way before, and he put a lot of suggestions as to how it could be improved. So who knows? Maybe the little pinky thing was his idea as well. I mean, they did say that it was a mixed blessing because it meant that, you know, they probably had more delays.
Yeah.
At the same time, at the end of the day, they could make a more perfect product to in keeping with his vision, you know?
Yeah.
But it did complicate the process a little bit.
Yeah.
Especially seeing as they're not actually doing it officially.
Right.
You know, where Bandai uses Kawamori as kind of a sales point. You know, they put it on the back of their boxes and stuff. Kawamori oversaw this.
Yeah.
But Yamato doesn't do that, and the reason for that is that it's actually not part of his job to do that. So... you know, they work in different ways.
Yeah, Takarto.
And also, Kawamori would sometimes not remember what the design was like. You know, he'd phone them up afterwards and say, "Oh yeah, I forgot. Sorry, the waist is like this or whatever."
Okay.
And they're like, "Oh."
I was gonna say, Takara did that with the Starscream. They had, you know, Kawamori's selling point. And that kind of backfired on them. But oh well.
Right, because everyone blamed him for he didn't design it. Like, we're talking about the Starscream, right?
Yeah.
He didn't design that. He redesigned some things. And you can actually see that they put up some old line art things with Kawamori's handwritten notes on it. You can see he drew some blobs on the sides of the waist. And then the next prototype we saw, they had those pylon things coming out.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Everyone thought he just ruined that design.
I like that version. Looks really...
I do too. Yeah. I don't care about... I don't even care about it being the right color, you know? I don't...
Yeah. Well, this was a really weird thing to make it that color for the main release. But,
it was. Yeah. It was, but I'm not so sure that a multicolored F-15 is something that I want at this point in my life, you know what I mean?
Well, I wonder if they had an agreement with Hasbro... Because that was their version, you know, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think it was so much that, more that Hasbro, that could have been the only one that Hasbro were willing to sell.
Yeah.
You know? Anyway,
so now we're getting into Macross Zero, right?
Yeah.
I think not, because we have the VVB6 first.
The Koenig Monster?
BB-6. Yeah.
That's kind of a lost toy. My friend D-Kun, or Michael, he and his friends got a bunch of stuff from a guy who was giving his collection away, and they got one. They didn't really know how to transform it. I was like, go to Macross World. They have the instructions scanned. But
has anyone made a video of that?
There's probably a video somewhere. That was,
I think,
that was an ambitious idea, but it's kind of like, it was never a perfect design to begin with, so, and it was like too complex for them at the time, with the materials they had, so it just kind of was kind of a middling.
I have to say though, I bought that probably on the day of release, at least a week of release. And the reason for that is that it was a toy that I'd always wanted since I played VFX2. I don't know why. I just really like that design. It's all chunky and blocky and unique. And Yamato used to do... I think they do it online now. But they used to include little bits of paper that were questionnaires. And they used to give you spaces to write three things that you would like Yamato to make next from their Macross series. And I always write the same thing. VB6 Koenig Monster. You know, never hoping that they would ever make these. Which is the one that... which is the one that goes underwater in VFX2?
The VA3M?
VA3M, or whatever. Intrepid Invader, right? yeah, Invader, and full armored Thunderbolt. I always wrote those three things, and I know they're all from VFX2. Well, I wasn't particularly a VFX2 fan or anything like that, but they just had the most interesting designs as far as I know. I don't care about the Invader anymore after seeing the Studio Half-Eye kit. So after a while, I started writing Variable Glaug, or Neo Glaug, or whichever one's the one that had the three-stage transformation. Mm-hmm. But I was always pleased that at least they got one of them to get made, the VB6. So I thought, hey, they listened to me. Somebody listens. So,
well, there were some...
Of course, I like the design, but I did buy it out of duty as well.
Yeah. Well, there was some like resin kit designs for that as well, so I think there was demand for it. So,
Yeah, I'm sure there was. I don't think it deserves all the hatred that it's gotten. Like, people say it's a bit crap and floppy and whatever. The floppiness you can fix, because none of those screws are hidden.
Yeah, so you can just take it apart.
You can open those up.
Give it some...
Yeah, and just tighten...
Nail polish, floor polish.
Tighten the hinges. Exactly. And that's what I've done, and it's fine now. In fact, I just transformed it the other day because somebody on Macrosworld wanted to see how...
Yeah, I saw that thread.
...compares with the Destroid, mm-hmm. right? And the only thing was that it has two prongs at the back where the in robot mode, the backpack folds down, and when you... Well, folds up, but when you fold it down when you want to turn it into, what is it, monster mode, Destroid mode, whatever you call it. Go-walk mode, I guess.
Yeah, Destroid mode.
And Destroid mode is actually not the Destroid, though, isn't it? It's the Batroid mode. That's the stupid thing about it.
Yeah, it has a really weird designation for it.
Anyway, those two prongs are supposed to hold the whole of the backpack,
mm-hmm.
and they're just made out of plastic, and they snap off.
Oh.
So, those snapped off very early on. But apart from that, it's still fine. It is funny that, on the arms, they should have, missile launchers. And they kind of open up. There's pop-up missiles in the middle of the arms. But it seems like they're not supposed to pop up. Like, they engineered it to... They planned to engineer it to pop up and be revealed, but it seems like they just decided to glue those down instead.
Mm-hmm.
So you can pull them up, but they'll just snap back in again.
All right.
And they're not painted or anything. So that's obviously some remnant of some scrapped design.
Yeah, it's always interesting when a toy has like some random Easter egg from an early design stage.
Yeah. Yeah, that had a couple of them,
I think. All right.
I don't know why the little shooting gun thing underneath the nose is so small either.
Well,
I guess I just couldn't figure out how to fit it in.
End of part 1.